This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
A very good morning to everybody. This is BFM 89.9, 12th of May 2021, 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, very nice and sharp on 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm Khoo Soo Chong with Philip C. And of course, and we welcome back the effervescent and the always luminous Wong Xiao Ning.
Effervescent and luminous. Wow.
Effervescent. What have you done wrong, Chong?
Nothing.
Better confess now.
Well,
I was away for a day, so I'm very nervous.
You see, I'm very comfortable. I'm usually very comfortable around you, but I'm even more comfortable around you today because you have been jabbed.
Yeah. I have had my vaccination.
Yes.
My AstraZeneca jab.
How'd you feel, darling?
Well, I had it on Monday, actually, after the show.
That's right.
So for some of you who noticed, how come she wasn't around after that?
We mentioned your name.
Okay, because I was at the University of Malaya, had my jab. It was an amazingly efficient process. I was in and out within an hour. Kudos to all the staff who, make sure that we know what we're supposed to do.
You sent the picture of the male nurse who attended to you.
I know, he was so sweet. He was like, don't worry, we're over very quickly. It won't be painful. And then
was he a bit charming as well?
Everyone was charming. And I would like to say, honestly, if every government department was run like the way the vaccination program was run, we would be a different place.
So how long was the process for you?
Very fast. I was in and out within an hour, and that was also because I was under the 30-minute observation because I'm asthmatic. If you have no serious illnesses, observation is only 15 minutes. You hand in your forms and then they kind of just try and arrange. They don't give you a specific date, but they put you in the list for the second jab.
So once the deed is done, you have to stick around for either 15 or 30 minutes to see whether there's a very serious adverse reaction.
Are there any side effects? Because clearly it's all kind of patted down already, right?
Yeah, I had a bit of side effects. I think I'll be honest, I felt fine when I went home, nothing. Mm. It only really bothered me or affected me literally 1 a.m. I woke up with a slight temperature.
Yes, we got the WhatsApp. 1:30.
1:30 in the morning, I had a bit of a temperature. I had a bit of a body ache. It's like how you would feel if you had the flu. I was like, I think it would be a challenge for me to get up at 4 and come into the studio. So I was like, I'll give myself a day off.
That's how these things work, right? They inject your body with the germs and then you build up a reaction, an immunity to it, right? That's how it works.
But there are different reactions.
So you're supposed to fall a bit ill,
But every vaccine has a different reaction. So apparently, if you take the Sinovac, if I'm not wrong, the reaction is worse in the second jab.
I see.
Oh. Versus the Astra, where you feel the side effects most on the first jab.
So that's why they say Astra is better, not so good for old people because...
No, I think people above a certain age apparently feel it less. That's the unique thing. But I think the point is, at the end of the day, just be aware that there will be some side effects. Some people feel nothing, lucky for you. And for those who do, it goes off very quickly. Just pop some Panadols, take a easy day. And now you are part of that race towards herd immunity.
Push. That's why I feel so safe around you. I feel so comfortable around you now, Wong.
But in the meantime, what do we have, Chuang?
Well, what have we got, Phil? What are you going to talk about?
We have a very interesting topic on inheritance and how do you kind of help wealthy parents manage money for wayward offspring, Chuang.
Why are you looking
I'm
at
looking
me?
I'm looking at you.
A, my parents are not rich, and B, I'm not wayward. Not in the traditional sense.
Not sure about that.
Well, I will talk about something else totally. It's about possibly the future of the world economy. And Wong?
Of course, I'll be going through all the international headlines that matter to us.
Alrighty then. So all that and more coming up after this, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9 cream with white room, possibly a space in the White House.
I don't think there's a white room in the White House. There's a green room.
Oh yeah, there is, isn't there?
Is there a green room?
I think so. There are a couple of coloured rooms, not a white room in the White House.
Yeah, anyway.
As usual, Trunk making up stuff on a Wednesday morning, especially on the eve of Hari Raya.
Well, that's how one likes to roll on the eve of a public holiday.
But credit for him for being creative.
Which is basically what we're going to talk about. Thank you, Phil, for saving my bacon. Well, this story comes from The Economist and most likely chosen by Phil himself.
No, of course not. Of course it was.
Okay.
Hands up here who have an Economist subscription.
I don't.
Only two of the three of us have
that's why
an Economist
read it,
subscription.
That's why it's like furiously looking for stuff that... Okay, so I'll leave it to you, Phil. It's basically the premise of the story is that does the new global economy center on the creator economy?
Okay, here's the stats. Children now, one third of them, rather be vloggers or YouTubers as opposed to being astronauts.
Wow.
3 times of them rather have their own YouTube or video link as opposed to being a doctor, astronaut, engineer. You know that the BFM advert, be a Dota player.
Yeah.
This is the next thing.
Yeah. It's the future. And, you know, in the past, if you want to get involved in being a creator, right, you have to be, you know, you have to be hired by TV3 or Astro.
Like a regular media outlet,
you
know, right?
Yeah. You don't need to now.
No, you can't. No, you don't. You just need a smartphone with an okay camera and all of them come with a microphone, right?
I think you still have to be quite creative and clever.
Definitely. 100%.
Definitely. 100%. Because the competition is intense.
Huge. And it's a global competition,
yeah,
right?
You know, you just look at Instagram, for example, and there are thousands and thousands, if not thousands, of reels. And some are bad, some are good, but I would say a lot of them which appear on my...
I've still got some reels, you know, I've done some.
You have?
Yeah,
okay.
I'm actually a creator. I've got my YouTube
okay,
YouTube
well,
channel,
your reels haven't popped up on my Instagram.
Have you?
You're not the target segment, Sean.
I'm not.
You're not the target segment, yeah. I suspect.
So the whole basis of this argument comes from the fact that finally, after 20 years, the social media platforms are going to start paying creators for their content, right?
Mm.
This all started from Australia, where Facebook faced basically a whole bunch of media unions, right? And finally now Facebook will start to pay for content, where in the past it just used to grab it for free, right?
Mm.
That's right. Okay. Correct. And this, I think this is the big opportunity for people to monetize.
Correct.
And the challenge you have, though, is that not everybody is still benefiting from it. It's a very small percentage, only 0.2% of actual subscribers are earning decent income.
Mm.
And even if they do, 80% of them are all still below the minimum wage equivalent.
So I was listening that day to this guy called Marcus Brownlee, right? Marcus Brownlee is MKBHD on YouTube. He's got 13 million subscribers on his YouTube channel.
You spend a lot of time on the World Wide Web, John.
Well, I'm at the forefront. I'm at the cutting edge, you see. And I like to stay there. I'm surfing that wave. So anyway, so for him to put out one video,
sorry,
right?
Pity's radio. You can't see our faces, but never mind.
So he was saying, right, to put out one video, it's an entire process which involves at least 6 to 7 people, right?
Mm.
You've got the guy who writes the script, then you've got the guy who presents it, which is him, then you've got the guy who shoots the video, right? Then you've got the editing process, then you've got the whole pre-upload process, which you've got to do the tagging, the headlines, the title, you know, all that promotion, marketing, social media stuff, right? And then you've got the whole process to continue the content cycle. It's a real thing. And he makes millions of dollars
a
year.
Okay, but he's probably like the 0.00001% of these guys, right?
Correct.
Most people start off as amateurs. They do it for fun. And then they evolve and they realize, hey, you can make some money out of it. And some do it very successfully and some don't. But I think what's interesting here is the bargaining power between what were the platforms has now maybe shifted more to the creators.
Yeah, and that's why you even have what we call influencer marketing, where even large corporates will pay these influencers to do the promotion. But what's also interesting happening now is that there are a lot of platforms for fans to subscribe to all this content. Just fans, only fans, you just pay a certain amount and you can do. And I'm sure there are many streaming apps where you can pay per view as well.
Yep.
If you download really good content. And as you were saying, Chuang, there's so many platforms for you to do that. A very good one is Substack. You know, everyone's been talking about Clubhouse. Substack is the equivalent, but for written content.
Ah.
You can even create your own customized newsletters.
I read about it in the New Yorker, I think. They had an article about it some people do quite well and some people don't go at all,
And it's a massive disruption. You know, we were always worried that Clubhouse would disrupt radio, but could Substack also do newspapers? Mm. Because then you have a question about guest columnists and all that stuff, and people instead will go and migrate to those kind of formats and forms instead of paying through an aggregated newspaper.
But do you think it will kill traditional media the way we see it? I think what it does is it doesn't necessarily kill it completely.
It's trying to adjust.
Yeah, but there will definitely be, you know, significant disruption. And we've already seen that, right, with the internet versus, let's say, newspapers or free-to-air TV.
Oh, for sure. I think our suspicion is that this is just the start of a big global mega trend, which will just gather more momentum as the years go by. Okay, it is 6:14 in the morning, 6:15 actually. We'll come back after this with some stories on wayward children and wealthy parents. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, okay. I'm Chuang Joy, Ma Shaoning and Philip C. Now, on to our Financial Times story and about how they've written about, well, the methodology that wealthy parents and how they should deal with their possibly wayward children. I just want to say, what amounts to wealthy nowadays? Is it middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class?
I think anyone with a lot of income, right? I think that basically it's high disposable income. Yeah. And as they age, as they turn 70, 80, they don't know what to do with it. Do they kind of distribute it to their kids already?
Okay, so it's all that whole succession. And will their children be as hungry as they were, right? Mm. So let's take it, you know, obviously we are... let's just out ourselves. I think we're strictly at least middle class, right?
Yes.
So how would you define maybe the three rules for, wealthy parents?
I think one of the biggest challenges I find with Asian parents is that they don't really talk about their wealth.
They don't like talking about wealth because it's somehow in their mind it equates to dying. I think that's...
Really?
A little bit of that.
Yeah.
Because you only kind of think about what you do with your money when you pass on, right? So it's all this... It's like very sensitive topics, you know. And then...
Oh, it's about what you do with your wealth after. But in terms of the lessons for other parents who are maybe coming into wealth, right? How do you treat your children? How do you make them as hungry as you are?
My parents, to be fair to them, when... You know, emphasize thrift from a very young age because they both came from extremely, extremely humble. Why are you laughing, Chua?
No, I've got a story about my kid. Actually, I'll tell you guys after this, okay?
Yeah. You know, it's about thrift from a very, because they both come from very humble backgrounds.
Yeah.
So I don't think Chinese parents, I mean, my parents, were shy about that conversation. The conversation, I think, which is the awkward conversation, is what do you do with the rest of your wealth? Like the inheritance. Yeah. That becomes a more sensitive topic.
I think
but
the worry,
like save money, don't spend money foolishly, think about it before you buy something, you know, you need to put aside for rainy day, get a good job. Asian parents love to have with their kids, okay?
All the time. It's like a mantra. A series of mantras.
Yeah, I wonder whether parents are worried that they don't want to talk about it because they want the children to also generate their own income and wealth.
You don't
want
to spoil them, right?
And they don't want to spoil them. Yeah. And that's one of the biggest challenges I feel Asian parents will have. They want the children to be able to not be overly dependent on them and so fend for themselves, essentially.
Yeah, but then equally I've also come across parents who have really spoiled their children because they've come from such terrible backgrounds, right? So they just overcompensate, especially if they work very hard, right? Mm. They just overcompensate with things and gifts and material items. And then he or she becomes a wastrel. And that's terrible, right? But I want to cite my story yesterday because I was going to go and work out with my daughter, right? Mm. Not that I'm very rich.
Who we have met, by the way, and is like a mini Chuang. Totally adorable.
She's so talkative. She just goes on a mile a minute, right? So she's just telling me about how about the good old days. You know, kids now, you talk about the good old days, right? She's 11, right? So the good old days.
What good old days at 11, but never mind.
2019, when there was sports day, then they had family day, you know, in school, there was gathering. So those are the good old days for them, right? Because they've been stuck at home for the last 15
poor things,
months, right?
Right.
So then they'll say, oh, you know, last time in the good old days and the family day, and then my friend said, you know, you can buy tokens to go and buy stuff and enter competitions. So my friends, you got 200 ringgit, 200 ringgit. Then, you know, mummy gave me 20 ringgit, you know. We only had 20 ringgit to like, So we couldn't enter competition. We had to choose what to buy. Then I thought to myself, you know, this is Asian upbringing, you know. You don't want to spoil them, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
It's not a bad thing. It's a lesson within that 20 ringgit, right?
Yes.
Make choices and make the right choices for yourself.
Yeah. I have to say one of the biggest lessons I've learned and very useful is that you must associate wealth with work.
Mm.
And one of the things, and I was talking to our intern more and myself, is that when I was very young, I would go to my dad's office and see how work was like. And then you kind of understand, okay, that's how wealth is generated. I don't think we're doing that enough in our society. We don't kind of help our children see that actually to generate this amount of wealth requires this amount of work. Because people kind of say, oh, daddy goes to office and then comes back and daddy's for play or whatever, or mommy. They need to see that actually that wealth requires quite a bit of work. And so going to the office, I feel, really helps for people manifest it.
I think that's a very good point, so that you can also see the value of your own work later on in life, right? And you have pride in what you do. But for me, the greatest lesson, or how I kind of, when I look at my relationship with my parents and how in so many ways, you know, when it comes to the topic of money, the one thing I appreciate them is that they never hid from me and my sisters the sacrifices that they made in order to accumulate wealth so that we could do the things that we wanted to do, like go overseas to study, for example. You know, because you do need to set aside money in order to do that. So as parents, you make these decisions today for your children's future. And that act of sacrifice really emphasizes to me that, you know, wealth is great, but it needs to be something that you appreciate. You don't take for granted, right?
I think that's important. Warren Buffett had this really good saying, a very rich person should leave his kids enough to do anything, but not enough to do nothing.
Yeah, that's such a good point of view. And I don't know, right? I'm just trying to square this what is can only be described as traditional thinking with the world that we have come into, not even entering, come into, right? And in today's world, even today's millennials, right, and even Gen Zs, right, it's about, you know, not foregoing that, it's about satisfying your wants now. It's about getting that experience now. Mm. It's about satisfying that desire now, because you don't know what the future holds, right? And part of that problem lies with us, because we were the ones who left this world to them. The environment is dying. There's corruption everywhere. There's avarice and greed everywhere you look, right? So you've got no, you can't blame them for wanting to have that stuff now. Do you know what I mean, right?
Yeah.
It's tough.
But I think delayed gratification has its merits.
Of course it does. And you and I understand that. All three of us understand that. But for children, you know, it's a tough one. I mean, if you can tell us what you think, it's something worth considering. At BFM Radio is the Twitter handle, or 018-789-8899. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. At this point in the morning, we normally talk about international news. And what better place to start than in China, where it is deciding whether to scrap. It's not scrapped. It used to have a one-child policy, right? And then now, a few years ago, I think in 2016, they allowed females to have two children in China.
Under certain circumstances. Yeah.
But it's not working because fertility rates and birth rates are dropping, right? So now they're
they
a bit
just
of
have
a
to
conundrum.
Look at Singapore to learn.
Right. Yeah.
Once you've kind of implemented a one-child policy, or, you know, fewer children policy, it's
they realize how blissful it can be.
Oh my goodness.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm sure you love your kids very much.
I know,
much.
But
yes, you with two kids especially. Yeah, but the biggest problem with China is that its working population is aging tremendously.
Correct.
And that's the problem here, because the forecast is that by 2030, nearly a quarter of the population will be above 60 years old.
Correct. And the other thing is that they're trying to transition to this consumption-led economy, right? So you need people to work and then earn, and then you can use that to pay and buy stuff. So if fertility rates drop, then they won't be as powerful. And there's also the power thing as well, right? Because the bigger you are, the more populous you are, then the more influential you are in the world. Right?
Yeah. They seem to trend towards Japan already, because that number seems to be what the number is currently now in Japan.
Yes.
Where nearly 30% of the population is above 60 years old. And that's, I think, the problem.
Yeah, because then your triangle, your population triangle starts to invert, right?
Mm.
Where your base becomes smaller. And then basically the smaller base has to support a much larger, wider, older population. Now, what's interesting about China is that, you know, how can they overcome this? Of course, you've had questions about whether China should move towards greater automation, less reliance on its own population to actually produce the GDP. Is that possible? I suppose they are trying. But, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch China actually really transition. And they're trying very hard, right? Because they're trying to move towards a consumption middle class society. Now, whether they can move fast enough is the question mark, because apparently their population will peak in 2030.
Well, China's only now waking up to something that Singapore, Japan, Sweden have
Europe.
Known for Europe have known for years.
Russia is the other one, actually.
Right? Yes.
Because the wealthier you get, right, the less inclination you have to have children, because A, you don't have time and you're working all the time, right? And B, you also realize that with wealth comes autonomy, and, you know, there's a direct correlation between wealth and education and birth rates. For example, with places like Nigeria, Bangladesh, and many parts of India, birth rates are off the scale, right? And people are having babies like this going out of fashion. But in Singapore, they're not. Japan, they're not.
Right? You know, the only developed country that doesn't have this problem or affliction is the United States.
Yeah, 330. They just had a census.
No, actually, you know why? Because they have, until recently, they had a actually quite generous, I would call it accommodative immigration policy.
Yeah,
yes.
That's
so
right.
So if you're seeing that your population is not growing, the next best thing is to encourage people to move to your country and be the new labor force, which is what US did, maybe till Trump, of course, you know, build the wall.
I think even Japan tried to do that. They tried to open up the doors, but because it's a pretty homogenous society there, it was very hard to assimilate.
They allowed it for, let's say, certain segments of work. So for healthcare, of course, people looking after the aged, domestic workers, but it wasn't aggressive enough. And you know, for them, it's really strange. They see tourism as short-term immigration.
Great. Well, not so great.
Go there for 2 weeks and then come home and then you're an immigrant for 2 weeks.
US used to give visa for like 10 years, right? It was brilliant.
I had it.
Yeah, so did I.
It was great. It was brilliant. Yes. But what is not so brilliant is the fact that in Myanmar, Burma, right, it's been 3 months of junta rule, and obviously the protesters there have marked this celebration, unlike in Malaysia with Selamat Hari Raya, right, with protests because it's been less than optimal over there.
So my question is, where is the ASEAN envoy? Who is the ASEAN envoy? And why are they not doing anything about it?
Yeah, there was supposed to be a special envoy, right?
There was supposed to be an envoy. It was announced with huge fanfare about a month ago. But since then, nothing has happened. There's even reports to say that the Myanmar army has said no ASEAN envoy visit until stability is restored. Whereas the intention initially from the Jakarta summit was to make sure that there has to be no more violence. And why is this continuing on?
Everybody's too busy fighting COVID, maybe. But this.
Oh, you know what you do if you're a political leader, you just lie low, and then you hope that the world forgets. Unfortunately,
yeah, that's the trouble with these summits and these subcommittees, right? Nothing ever gets done. Okay, very quickly in the Middle East, hostilities between Israel and Hamas have, of course, escalated again. I've seen some pictures. I saw some Twitter feeds last night. It's getting really bad, right?
Yes,
and
it is.
People are just. I mean, I saw over Tel Aviv, there was this, I think they fired, I think the Hamas fired 130 rockets into Tel Aviv, and these interceptor missiles were like...
Yeah, it's called the Iron Dome system, which beat the Iron Dome.
Incredible. It's really escalating.
But it's sad because, you know, the death toll now has risen to 30 Palestinians and 3 Israelis. And I mean, it doesn't seem like it's going to end anytime soon.
Of course. So, of course, our thoughts go out to everybody afflicted in that part of the world. As we, have the good fortune to celebrate Raya, which happens, in fact, tomorrow. So, in fact, on that note, I'd like to just wish everybody Selamat Hari Raya. We're going to come back after this with some local news. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. Chuang here with Shaunig and Philip C. Great song, great time of year, and Selamat Hari Raya to everybody, because we've got a few days of festivities coming up in the next. In fact, it's going to be a long weekend.
I'm getting
Thursday,
a long,
Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Yeah, it's going to be brilliant.
Yes, I'm getting a lot of WhatsApps of smells of people cooking stuff and saying it's really bau, wangi and all that stuff, but I can't taste any of it.
Don't make me so hungry now.
Well, you can't visit your friends during this Raya, but it shouldn't stop you from sending food to them.
Hint, hint.
I'm very tempted to go to my neighbor's house. My neighbor's house is this old Malay guy, right, who I go cycling with, and he's a really super guy, right? But I can't go and visit him because he's always got some nice food in his house, man.
Just ask him to pack it in little containers and then you can just take it from the gate.
Yeah. That'd be really benign thing to
do, right? Mini Grab, like a mini Grab or Food Panda.
Okay, so Stephen Chalaya wrote in a nice message a few minutes ago about how we talked about how, you know, saving for a rainy day. So he says that, good morning, guys. He's actually got Ceylonese parents, right? And his Ceylonese parents always talked about saving for the rainy day. And they're right. He said, there's no safety net today.
Very true. We've always had this huge debate about EPF and, you know, Account One and SINA, iSINA, and how that's kind of depleting our safety net as well, and the concern of the role of the EPF going forward.
You had a side convo with Ro, didn't you, Wong?
Yes.
He talked to you.
Well, he was basically saying that, that nothing unique, he WhatsApped in and he said, nothing unique about an older person reaction to the vaccine versus the young. A younger person's immune system is far more ready to fight the infection. So apparently there's a stronger reaction. And I was like, hey, I feel younger already because I had a bit of a bad reaction.
you see, this is out of the conversation.
Well, talking about news on vaccines, pretty good news, the Sinovac vaccine is ready for rollout. I think a lot of people are anticipating that after we've already rolled out the Pfizer and the AstraZeneca. So our health minister has said that they have completed the fill and finish for about 1.2 million and a batch of about 300,000, 290,000 have been released.
Okay, so for those among you who are still hesitant about vaccines, I want to talk about this story from Bloomberg about how the health minister from Indonesia, Budi Gunadi Sadikin, gave an interview, right? And he talked about how Indonesia has tracked about 25,000 health workers in Jakarta for 28 days after they took the Sinovac vaccine. And every single one of them, basically, was protected from death, and 96% was protected from hospitalization as soon as 7 days after inoculation, which is interesting.
That's great news, because you can see good case studies for all the three vaccines. Mm. You have seen in UK with AstraZeneca how the cases have dropped. Now you've talked about Indonesia with Sinovac, and Israel, US with Pfizer. I think you can show the efficacy across
the board. Yeah, and imagine UK, first time ever in, 1 year plus, not a single death due to COVID-19.
So I talked to my friend in the UK, actually. He was in a pub over the weekend, and everybody was so busy, so happy, because they were able to go and meet their mates and, have a bit of a laugh.
A bit of life coming back to normal. But I think we shouldn't keep our eye off the ball. And this is because if you look at what's happening in Taiwan, for example, they are starting to clamp down on group meetings once again because clusters were forming. And even in Singapore, that has been the case. So, the question is, yes, there is this optimism when it comes to vaccinations, but it doesn't mean that COVID-19 is not going to be with us for at least the foreseeable future. And I think that's an important point to take away.
A bit like the flu, really. Okay, the Edge Daily is in front of me. Page 6.
But far more deadly, though.
Far more deadly, yes. So Public Bank reported quarterlies last night, first quarter, and again, a bumper year for them. This is a financial juggernaut. They made 1.5 billion ringgo in net profit, right? But what is interesting for me is their impaired, the money that they set aside for bad loans has dropped by at least 60% to just 200 million ringgit in the first quarter. So they expect things to get better from here on in, and they do not expect loans to go sour, which is interesting from a dividend perspective. It means that they can return money to shareholders, maybe more easily in the future.
I suspect banks throughout this quarter have been very resilient and they've really managed to hold themselves well throughout this crisis.
I definitely think so. I mean, it's probably the indication that the worst is over from an economic point of view. And even though we have MCO 3.0, it won't be as bad as what we experience in MCO 1.0 or even MCO 2.0. But we will have this conversation about Malaysia's GDP with Julia Goh, senior economist at UOB at 7:45 a.m. So do tune in. And later on at 8:45, we will also be talking to Tricia Yeo, the CEO of Ideas, about MCO 3.0, and are you confused about all the SOPs and how things perhaps could be done better? Tune in at 8:45.
I'm confused. CMCO, RMCO, MCO.
Is it true that they're going to issue another set of SOPs with respect to this MCO 3.0?
This is what Ismail Sabri said. It's just one defined set for the whole country. That's what he was in the press yesterday about.
And this is the frustration again, right? Which is, we announce something, but the SOPs follow after. Would have been ideal if they had done it concurrently together, no?
Yeah, ideally. But what was unusual was yesterday was the first ever joint press conference, right, with our Director General of Health, Tan Sri Noor Hisham, together with our Defence Minister, Dr. Sri Sabri. Never before. We've been in this COVID-19 health crisis for more than a year, but this was the first ever joint PC.
I wonder why it's such a big deal.
Maybe they were like loggerheads before, right?
Well, maybe it's a good thing in a way. Then when you have these joint press conferences, maybe there's less confusion. The press can ask the questions and both of them can reply rather than issuing different things later on.
Okay, good news. Masayoshi is buying part of Ada Ada. Masayoshi via SoftBank is investing 250 million ringgit, about $60 million in Axiata's digital marketing subsidiary, ADA. That buys them a 23% stake. So that makes ADA a ringgit unicorn. Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think ADA really built on its relationship with Axiata, the database and all that. And I think has really established itself as a very strong digital marketing agency in ARM.
Okay, 6:56, we'll come back after this with the news. And then after that, a market discussion with our favourite ocker from down south, Jacuzzi, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.